Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk, no nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
May 20th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, criminal defense attorney in New York, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. We have a great show today. Please check out all of our prior episodes at blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw. That's T-A-L-K-I-N law, blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw. Last week we had a great show. We spoke to Paige Kreuter, former Baltimore prosecutor who analyzed the case of the six Baltimore police officers charged in connection with the Freddie Gray homicide. Check out that show and all our other shows on blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw. Follow the show by keeping up with us on Facebook, facebook.com/talkinlaw. Please like the facebook.com/talkinlaw page. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, H-O-C-H-H-E-I-S-E-R. And I want to hear from our listeners, so please send me an email. TalkinLaw@gmail.com. That's TalkinLaw@gmail.com. You can make comments, suggest guests you'd like to hear on the show, or tell me anything you like. Anyway, we have a great show today. We will have the question of the day first about the millions of criminal summonses issued by the NYPD over the past 7 years as part of the broken windows policing policy. We will then have guest Dr. Charlotte Laws on the program, who has been called the Erin Brockovich of revenge porn. We will answer the question of the day, and then we'll go to Beth Karras, who will speak to us about the legal developments in the Adnan Syed case, which was made very popular and famous by the Serial podcast, and we will talk about the decision this week by the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland, which granted new life to Adnan Syed's hopes for getting a new trial. We will then answer, we will have the answer to the question of the day actually before Beth, and that will be our show. So, question of the day is, how many of the 3.8 million criminal summonses issued by the NYPD between 2007 and 2014 were dismissed based upon legal insufficiency? Now, let me properly introduce our guest. Dr. Charlotte Laws is known throughout the world as the Erin Brockovich of revenge porn. She is a writer, television commentator, former California politician, magazine cover girl, and also knows something about crashing a party and slipping past the Secret Service. She is the author of the book Rebel in High Heels, which is a memoir about her life, including her efforts to visit justice upon the man who posted her daughter's topless photo on the internet. She is an anti-revenge porn activist, an animal rights activist, and a nonconformist who abstains from meat, alcohol, and drugs. Dr. Charlotte Laws, are you with me?
I am.
Doctor, no meat, no alcohol, no drugs? How do you get through the day?
That's the way it is.
Great to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time this morning. I really appreciate it.
Sure,
Oh, you're welcome. Now, before we get into it, your new book is out, Rebel in High Heels. How can people get the book?
They can get it on Amazon or on Barnes & Noble, and it should be in bookstores in a couple of weeks.
Excellent. Looking forward. Before we get to the book, which is a fascinating topic about your anti-revenge porn activism and your life. Tell us briefly about your background, where you grew up, circumstances of your childhood, etc.
I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and I was adopted at birth. And I had a tragic childhood. My adoptive mom committed suicide. My brother was killed in a car accident 2 years later when he was 16. And I had kind of a verbally abusive dad. And I come from old money Atlanta, so it was kind of a snobby community. And I basically spent my childhood trying to escape. And I was attacked for supporting the civil rights movement back in Georgia, so I was always the outsider, and finally escaped to Los Angeles. I went to school in Florida first and then in Las Vegas and ended up in Los Angeles.
So, and what's your family situation currently? You have one child, more than one child?
I have one daughter, and I'm married. My husband is not the daughter, not the father of my daughter. And so I was a single mom when I raised her. Her father lives in New York. And we live in Los Angeles, and we have 9 chickens and 2 dogs. I have 9 rescue chickens.
9 chickens, 2 dogs, 1 daughter.
That's it.
Sounds like the beginning of a joke, no?
It does.
your daughter, how old is she now?
My daughter is 28 years old.
All right. So, and the reason I'm asking these personal questions is because it has everything to do with the book and your efforts to bring Hunter Moore and a cyber hacker to justice. So who is Hunter Moore?
Hunter Moore was the most nefarious revenge porn website owner and enjoyed humiliating women, misogynistic, had a cult called The Family. His followers would tell him that they would kill for him. It was kind of a Charles Manson type of cult, as far as the language goes. And he was very popular on the internet. He was glorified by the media. He would post nude pictures of women from really all over the world, but certainly all over the United States. And he would put their name, their social media link, any identifying information that could be found would be posted by him or his followers, including the workplace, maybe their father's phone number. The goal of the followers was to harass the woman, try to get her to commit suicide, try to get her fired, basically to destroy lives.
And when was the first time you heard Hunter Moore's name?
When my daughter was hacked. Hunter Moore had hired a hacker to obtain photographs for the website. And my daughter had taken a topless picture 3 months prior, which she had never had any intention of showing anyone. She had taken over 100 just regular pictures in her room, and one of them was topless. And so when she got hacked and ended up on that website, then she called me in tears and told me about the site and about Hunter Moore, and that's when I learned about him.
How old was your daughter at the time the photo was taken?
She was 20. She was either 24 or 25. She was born in December of 86, so whatever that is. It was in January
okay.
of 2012 is when it happened.
Okay, so at least at the time she was adult, which doesn't make it good, but at least she wasn't a child. And so this Hunter Moore posts this photo, topless photo of your daughter, and when did you begin going after him and seeking justice for your daughter and trying to get this photo removed, et cetera?
Well, I immediately started trying to get the photo removed, and I quickly learned that he never removed photographs. I used the takedown notice, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but that did not succeed with him. And I quickly also learned that there was the hacking scheme. And the media at the time was saying that revenge porn was only about disgruntled ex-boyfriends and ex-girlfriends. And I knew that there was a hacking scheme because my daughter's friend also ended up on the site with a topless picture, and she had been hacked as well. And so while I was trying to get the picture removed, I started contacting victims or individuals who were depicted on his site to find out how they got on there, and found out that 40% had been hacked. And then I started helping the victims get their photos removed, which is why I got the Erin Brockovich title, and got the FBI involved. And so it ended up being a very grueling experience, which resulted in computer viruses, death threats, a stalker at my house, because Hunter Moore had such an avid following of these, you know, these kids that they would kill for him or do anything for him to protect him. So it was really quite an ordeal.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Dr. Charlotte Laws, author of Rebel in High Heels, which is a memoir about her life, including her efforts to fight revenge porn cyber hackers. Dr. Laws, was there any relationship before your daughter's photo was posted on the internet between Hunter Moore and your daughter?
No, she did not know him, and she did not know the hacker. But oddly enough, when we learned the hacker's identity, we found out that he doesn't live that far from our house. In fact, the high school he went to was only 2 blocks from the house where Kayla was raised. So that was really coincidental, because he was hacking people all over, and it was quite random. It was a matter of whichever Facebook page he could take over, and then he would take over that person's email, and he would just branch out from one Facebook friend to another to another. It was whoever had nude pictures in their email and whoever's account he could get access to. That was what it was all about.
You see, it seems to me that when I think of revenge porn, is I think that somebody hacks somebody's account or posts a photo or a sexual video of, you know, some kind of ex-lover. But here, this seems more of just sort of hacking for sport. It doesn't seem to be any revenge involved in your daughter's case. Am I missing something?
No, I mean, it's, you're right. In a sense, it's a misnomer, the phrase revenge porn, although it is revenge on women in a sense, because 90% of victims are female. But I would say that it's more like non-consensual pornography or cyber rape, because the victims act like traditional rape victims. They feel helpless, they go into the fetal position, they want to shut down their online presence, block out the world. So that's the reaction. It is a sex crime, and so I think that, you know, cyber rape is a better way to explain it.
Now, what happened to Hunter Moore? You said you got the FBI involved. My understanding is he was arrested, he was prosecuted. Tell us the status of that investigation.
Well, he has pleaded guilty, and he faces between 2 to 7 years in prison and then 3 years of monitored or supervised, you know, release afterwards, along with a $500,000 fine. The sentencing date is on June 24th, so currently I am gathering together victims to speak at the sentencing or to send letters to the judge. The biggest issue is that most victims do not want to be identified, and so we have to do it incognito.
And how about, there was only one cyber hacker involved, this person who lived close to your daughter, by coincidence, in terms of the incident with your daughter's topless photo. What happened
right
to that cyber hacker?
He doesn't have a plea deal yet. So he is facing 42 years in prison currently. And he has a trial date that's supposed to start in 2 weeks, but I'm assuming there'll either be a plea deal or there'll be a continuance of that date. I do have a meeting today with the prosecutor and the lead FBI agent, so I assume that I'll have more information in about 4 or 5 hours. They wouldn't tell me anything over the phone, so I don't know what the nature of that meeting is going to be. But he has confessed to the media. He confessed to CNN in a piece that aired about 2 weeks ago. In fact, they called him from my house, and he confessed over the phone, on speakerphone, on their cameras. And so, and he also confessed, kind of semi-confessed to KTLA-TV like a year ago, which is a local news station in Los Angeles. So he told CNN that he thought he would get 2 to 3 years in prison, but I'm not sure why, because to my knowledge, there's no plea deal, and the FBI agent tells me that there is no plea deal at this point.
So what U.S. Attorney's Office is prosecuting that case?
It's the Los Angeles. Everything's happening in Los Angeles.
All right. Let's talk about across the United States. I know you've been active in efforts to enact so-called anti-revenge porn laws. First of all, what is essentially an anti-revenge porn statute? What elements does such a statute contain generally, and what's the purpose of such a statute?
Well, it would basically say that no one could post or distribute nude or topless pictures without the person who is depicted's consent. So that's pretty much what it says. We currently have 18 states with laws against revenge porn, and Representative Jackie Speier of California plans to bring forth a federal law this year. And it's really important because the perpetrators, both the people who submit these photos and the guys who run these websites, and I say guys because it's pretty much almost always 20 to 30-year-old kids who live at home with their parents who do this, they're very afraid of law enforcement, but they are not afraid of civil lawsuits. And I think it's partly because they have no assets, partly because they figure the woman is going to have to pay an attorney $50,000 to $60,000 to bring the lawsuit to fruition, and also because of something called the Streisand effect, which means that there was a case many years ago with Barbara Streisand where she didn't want her home address depicted, so she brought a lawsuit against someone who did put her home address out there, and because she brought the lawsuit, all the media covered it, and everybody knew her address. So women are afraid that when they bring a lawsuit forward, their name will be connected to the civil suit, and then all of a sudden they're connected with nude pictures, which is exactly what they're trying to avoid in the first place. Now we do
the old catch 22. You're
exactly
listening to Talking Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to Dr. Charlotte Laws, author of Rebel in High Heels, talking to us about anti-revenge porn laws across the United States. Dr. Laws, forgive my ignorance, but does New York have an anti-revenge porn statute?
I think, you know what, I can't even remember if it's one of the 18 states. I'd have to look at the list. But we have a list on endrevengeporn.org, which is basically the website that I'm associated with. We have a group called Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, and so it's a resource for victims. You can go to endrevengeporn.org, and there's a map there of all the states. And I can't remember if I knew New York at one point definitely tried to bring something forward, and I think there is a law, but I'm not 100% sure if that passed. Some states have had to bring forth the legislation twice to try to get it passed. I know Florida recently just passed the law, but they had tried to pass it several years back, and it did not succeed the first time. So anybody who's listening can go to that map and see if their state is included.
Additionally, I want to remind our listeners that they should go to rebelinhighheels.com to check out information about Dr. Law's new book. Get the book, read it, learn about anti-revenge porn law and Dr. Law's efforts to stamp it out. Dr. Laws, before we switch to different topics, because I have a few other things I want to talk to you about, how is your daughter doing in the aftermath of this bad experience with having this topless picture of her posted without her consent? Is she doing okay? Does she have a career? Has this hurt her? What's going on?
Well, she's much better now that the picture's down. Her career is real estate. She's been a real estate agent for about a year. She kind of goes back and forth on how she feels about being linked with this issue. She's happy that we're making such strides and so many things have happened in the last 3 years to protect victims and get laws passed. But on the other hand, she's not thrilled that her name is associated online with revenge porn because she's afraid that it's going to hurt her real estate career or any other career that she pursues in the future.
Now, let's switch gears, if you don't mind. Let's talk Bill Cosby for a moment. My understanding is that you had a friend whose name was Sandy who had a bad experience with Mr. Cosby that you have information about?
Right. One of my closest friends, when I lived in Las Vegas, I lived there for 2 years, one of my closest friends there had dated Bill for several years in a consensual relationship. And she introduced me to him, and he drugged her at some point and then had sex with her, but she did not consider it rape at the time because she'd already been dating him for several years. She was felt betrayed. She didn't understand it. She was extremely wild, I would say. I mean, she was the kind of person in Vegas that if he had said, yeah, let's have an orgy with 10 people, she would have said, sure. I mean, that's the kind of girl she was. So the fact that he drugged her made no sense whatsoever. And so I don't know that she saw him after that, because I stayed in touch with Bill for 35 years, and I didn't know that he was drugging people. I thought maybe this was a mistake. He had given her a couple of pills and said, these will relax you. And I just thought maybe they reacted to her body in some unusual way, or it was some kind of an error. I certainly didn't think he was out there drugging women. And in 2005 is when I learned that there were other individuals who were victims of Mr. Cosby, and I was really shocked, and I didn't really know what to do at the time. I didn't know whether I should come forward or not. I wasn't a victim myself. He was always extremely kind to me and gave me advice about my life, and, you know, very paternalistic, and, you know, so I didn't have a bad experience personally. And at the time, I decided not to come forward because there were other women who were coming forward to support the first woman, and because I wasn't a victim myself, so I wasn't sure that my testimony even was relevant. And but however, last year, I finally decided that I should go ahead and tell the story, which I did in a piece in Salon.
How did you meet Bill Cosby?
I was introduced by my friend who had been dating him. Sandy.
This is the Sandy woman who was drugged?
Yeah, not her real name, but that's the name I used to talk about her, yeah. So she introduced me in his dressing room at the Hilton in Las Vegas, and I probably saw Bill maybe 12 or 15 times over the years. Just if, you know, if he was in town and I was in town, I would go backstage and say hello and hang out for a little while. And, you know, he was always very nice to me, so that's
when,
why.
When was the first time Sandy told you about this sexual assault that she said she claims she?
It was back in 1981, so this was a long, long time ago.
And when did she first tell you?
She told me, like, right after it happened. So
you didn't tell anybody till when, 2005?
Oh, no, I told tons of people. All my friends knew about it all these years. I didn't tell the media. And, I mean, to me, the story back then was the fact that he was cheating on his wife, and the media never covered that. And that's what I always thought was so surprising, considering there was the National Enquirer, there were all these tabloids, and I was always surprised that the media never covered that. I had no idea he was drugging women. I knew he was cheating on his wife. But, you know, to me, it wasn't my business, and I'm not going to go running to the media to say, oh, Bill Cosby's cheating on his wife. So to me, it just wasn't my business. But, yeah, I told tons of friends, and everybody that knows me knew about the drugging or knew what happened to Sandy a long time ago.
Now, let's talk about the Secret Service. My understanding is that you have successfully slipped past the Secret Service four times, twice involving President Reagan, once involving presidential candidate John Kerry, for President Obama at George Clooney's estate. Tell us about those incidents and why and how you did it.
The first time was not even intentional. I was 20 years old, and this was at the inaugural ball for Reagan in Washington, D.C., and it wasn't intentional. The room was so crowded, and I became extremely claustrophobic. I mean, you just could not even move across the room. But there was this very uncrowded VIP section that was guarded by Secret Service agents and a velvet rope. And I just started crying, and they literally opened the rope and let me in, and I was able to talk to Reagan and Jimmy Stewart and Rich Little and a bunch of different celebrities who were there. And so that's what happened the first time. The second time, I wanted to interview Reagan for my book that was coming out in 1988. And this was sometime in the mid-80s. I don't, like, maybe 84. I'm not quite sure of the year. And so I first called the White House to ask if I could interview him, and they said no. They said he has a hiatus from reporters for 3 weeks. And so I knew that his staff was staying at the Beverly Hilton in Los Angeles, so I went over there. I saw these men setting up camera equipment outside the lobby. I assumed they were with the White House. I also knew that the president went to a party at Walter Annenberg's every New Year's Eve. And so I basically went over to these men and said, hey, does anybody need a date for New Year's Eve? And the chief White House photographer said, yeah, I could use a date, but we're going to Palm Springs. Do you want to go all the way down there? And I said, no problem. I said, will the president be there? And he said, absolutely. And he took my name and information for a background check, and I ended up being his date at this event, and I was able to interview the president, which was great. And then at the John Kerry event, it was $25,000 per person to attend this amazing event. I mean, it was really a nice event, I have to say. And basically what I did is I went through the metal detectors. And by the way, I always went through metal detectors. I could not have gotten into any of these events with a gun or a knife. So I feel the Secret Service did their job. I mean, I don't feel they were, you know, to be faulted in any way. But I basically jumped into the group of the VIPs who had come out of this little private dinner thing to go to the main show, and I just kind of finagled past the door, and one of the Secret Service agents was screaming at me, wait, I didn't see your ticket, come back here, and I just ignored him and went on in. And then I wanted to go backstage to the green room, which is where everybody was, so all the celebrities, and it was really a nice little event back there. So I basically kind of befriended this actress and walked backstage with her. What happens if you like start talking to somebody, as you walk past security, they think you're with the person. And so I ended up in this room with John Kerry and Leonardo DiCaprio and Ben Stiller and Ben Affleck and Robert De Niro, and Barbara Streisand was kind of coming to the door. And I mean, everybody was there. It was kind of an amazing little thing. Neil Diamond, everybody was backstage. And so, and then the last event, I had actually just, this was only in 2012. And I mean, normally when I do it now, I don't do it that often anymore. Mainly the gate crashing happened when I was like 16 to 25 years old. But sometimes I do it because it's a great way to talk to politicians about legislation. It's a great way to get somebody, you know, signed on to a nonprofit cause. There are a lot of benefits associated with hobnobbing with the rich and famous. So I decided I wanted to go to this party at George Clooney's. I showed up late because I was actually not able to get there earlier that evening. And essentially what happened was there was this barrier. They had it, the whole streets were all blocked off around George Clooney's estate, but they removed the barrier temporarily. And that's when I just kind of bolted up the hill in my car. I got flagged down by a security guard, and he told me I had to turn around and go back down the hill. And I had this Rite Aid bag on my seat, which actually had ponytail holders in it, and I pretended to be reading a little piece of paper and said, oh, I have this emergency pharmaceutical delivery for a G. Clooney. And the guy just didn't know what to do, and he said, all right, I guess you can go up. And he never checked
Dr. Laws, Dr. Laws, I would love to hear more about the gate crashing, but before you leave me, I want to ask you one last question, and if you could give me about 30 seconds on it, because we're almost out of time, but what is the bold zone?
Basically, it's just going at life with gusto. It's showing up. It's you know, going for your dreams, essentially. I mean, a lot of people don't show up in life, and so, you know, I'm advocating that people do that, and I'm advocating that they be persistent, because persistence is the key to success, and other-centrism or helping others is the key to happiness. And so I just think people should, you know, should pursue what they want in life, and you will be amazed at the success you can achieve.
Amen. Dr. Charlotte Laws, keep living in the bold zone. I will try to do the same. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Now, before we get to Beth Karas and discuss the latest developments in the Adnan Syed serial podcast case and the Colorado theater shooting trial, let's go to the answer to the question of the day. Question: how many of the 3.8 million criminal summonses issued by the NYPD between 2007 and 2014 were dismissed based upon legal insufficiency? Answer: according to the New York Times, records show about one-fifth or 850,000 of the 3.8 million criminal summonses issued by the NYPD between 2007 and 2014 were thrown out on grounds of legal insufficiency, which a federal judge has found was tantamount to a decision that probable cause was presumptively lacking. This issue is at the heart of the policy of the NYPD's broken windows policing strategy. Now, our listeners can make the decision for themselves whether 850,000 criminal summonses dismissed over the past, from the period 2007 to 2014, is too high a price to pay for trying to solve bigger crimes by arresting people for petty crimes. I will let you decide. Now, give me Beth Karas, give me Kiss.
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karas on Crime special report from Beth Karas, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news. What can I do?
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Beautiful day in New York, isn't it?
It's great to be in New York. It's wonderful. I was away for the weekend, though, and back to the home stretch. I am. Week four.
Cool. So the last thing I saw on the home trial was that the jurors were questioned about whether the death sentence in the Boston bombing Jokhar Tsarnaev case would affect their ability to be fair to James Holmes.
Well, actually, the defense had wanted a pretty rigorous examination into that because, you know, they said there were parallels, but the state was like, there aren't parallels, except, you know, the state is seeking death like the government did, and it was a mass killing. And the judge was like, you really want me to question them and draw more attention to it? So they left it alone. But there was a lot of colloquy before court on Monday morning regarding that. But every day, speaking of jurors, it seems almost every day, it's not every day, but almost every day, a juror passes a note to the bailiff who gives it to the judge when a witness's name is called out or a witness takes a stand. At least it happens maybe a couple times a week. And generally it's because a juror recognizes the name or actually knows the person who's about to testify. Because while this isn't a tiny community, the county, it is, you know, one out of nine people in that county were summoned for jury duty because they had a pool of 9,000 to start with. In any event, you know, one juror goes to a Christmas Eve party with her extended family, the in-laws, and this guy, a witness, is at it every year. She wasn't excused, but she knew he worked in law enforcement. He's a DA investigator, as it turns out. Another one knew a cop he had been assigned to the middle school where she worked, but it had been 5 years, but she used to engage him in conversation. So the judge examined them and make sure that it's not going to affect their impartiality. But in a community like this, with so many witnesses, you know, there have been 15 days of trial, 14 for testimony, and there have been 122 witnesses so far. The state will be about halfway through their case by the end of this week.
And what do you expect to happen today in court, Beth?
Well, they don't say in advance, and the witness list is sealed. So I can just tell you, based on the pattern, they pepper survivors with law enforcement testimony. There are so many crime scene investigators, people, because there were, you know, 70 people injured, three types of weapons fired, and everybody's collecting little bullet fragments. And yesterday we heard about the fragments collected at autopsy. There were 12 autopsies. Two coroners, that's what they call them, coroners did six each, three on July 20th, the day of the shooting, because the shooting was right after midnight, and then three the day after. So each of them did six for a total of 12, and we haven't heard from the coroners yet. So that's to come, the actual autopsy evidence. And we've heard from 39 survivors. The survivors were not all victims of gunshots. Some of them were uninjured. So there will be 70 who were injured to testify, and 39 so far, but that includes some witnesses who weren't injured. So there's a lot of survivors still to come, victims, and more law enforcement testimony and the medical examiner still to come.
Now, what about the question that some of our listeners may have, which is, I don't really understand, Beth. You know, there's no dispute about what happened because James Holmes' defense has admitted he did the shooting. So that's not an issue. Why do we need all these survivors to testify? Why do we need all the crime scene people to testify? Why don't we just move on to the testimony about whether Holmes was aware that what he was doing was wrong at the time he did it and the insanity issues?
Well, the state still has the burden, as you know, to prove every element of every one of the 166 counts charged. And so while it is largely unchallenged and the vast majority of witnesses are going uncross-examined unless their testimony somehow goes to the state of mind of the defendant, because that's the issue in the case, the state still has to put on their evidence. And a lot of what we're hearing now, should the case get to a penalty phase, should the jury reject the insanity defense, and there's a good chance they will, just because statistics show, bear out how difficult it is for the defense to actually prevail in an insanity case, chances are it's going to go to another phase. And the evidence being presented now is part of, in large part, the aggravation evidence. So it won't get represented. It'll all get sort of folded in, and maybe there'll be some extra things they'll add.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to Beth Karas of KarasOnCrime.com. Beth, before we move on to the Adnan Syed case in Maryland, can you tell us what's new on KarasOnCrime.com?
Well, I'm following the Holmes case and shooting videos almost every night. I record a video almost every night where I take questions from my members, which aren't only related to the Holmes case. So I'm answering their questions about the law, about other cases, and I'm still getting documents in the Jody Arias case. Believe it or not, the case has been over since March 5th, and there's still a lot of interest. And so I still continue to collect documents that have not been seen publicly. So those are coming on the way, and that's what I'm about to launch a newly designed website, which will also have a book corner, and so that we can engage in our conversations about who's reading what about true crime and fiction crime books.
Cool. Now let's go to the Adnan Syed case. I read this decision, which was handed down by the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland in the case of Adnan Syed versus the state of Maryland, where Mr. Syed was convicted of the 1999 murder of his ex-girlfriend, Hae Min Lee, and he was tried, he was convicted, and people found out about this case largely through the popular podcast called Serial. Now they have this decision, which I understand is largely based on a new affidavit from a woman named Asia McClain, who claims apparently in an affidavit, which I have not seen, but my understanding is that it says that she was with Adnan Syed at a library at about the time of the killing. What's the status of this case?
Right. Okay. So the appellate court has sent it back down to the circuit court, the trial level, and the defense has 45 days to make an application, basically to reopen their 2012 post-conviction relief hearing, which did not include testimony or the affidavit of Asia McClain. She's now married, living across the country, but she actually, I've seen this affidavit, I can send it to you, it is online because there's a new podcast and a new site called Undisclosed, which kind of picks up where Serial left off and is doing sort of the aftermath of Serial. It's not affiliated with NPR or Sarah Koenig, the reporter, but it does involve people who know Adnan Syed, the defendant who's been in prison for 15 years, and supporters of him. But there are a lot of documents on there, and it's called Undisclosed. If you search Undisclosed Podcast, you'll see that down at the bottom, there have been three episodes, you'll see documents, and you click on that, and you're going to see Asia McClain's affidavit. In any event, she claims that she has come forward almost since the beginning. The issue is that, one of the issues, is that the defense attorney at trial for Adnan Syed did not call Asia McClain as an alibi witness. She is now deceased. So one does
this
not.
This is Christine Gutierrez?
Gutierrez, yes. If it was strategy, or did she overlook it? Was it negligent? Or did she say, well, Asia really doesn't have anything to add? I don't know. It is dealt with a little bit in the Serial podcast that maybe Asia McClain was mistaken about the day that she says she saw Adnan in the library. She says she remembers it because the next day there were snowstorms. In any event, it was January 13th, 1999, sometime after 2:30 when school had just let out, when supposedly the victim was killed. And she says she was with Adnan at about 2:30 or so in the library, so she couldn't have been killed around 2:36. And so it's really important. So the court is now saying, look, you know, her testimony should be considered in this post-conviction relief proceeding. It should be considered. Had the jury heard her testimony, maybe it would have made a difference in the outcome. Maybe he'll get a new trial. So that's what's going on now. I mean, for the first time, her testimony is going to be considered, or at least her affidavit.
Right. And to read from the decision, what they said specifically was, in light of this new evidence, talking about this affidavit you just described, Beth, Syed asserts that a remand to the circuit court would be in the interest of justice, that it would promote judicial economy, and that Ms. McClain's testimony is reasonably likely to change the outcome of the post-conviction proceeding. Now, this is not a done deal. My understanding is the trial court still has to accept this application from the defense to have a hearing about the affidavit, which is likely to occur, but not definitely.
Right. It's not definite. It sounds like the appellate court is not ordering them to have the hearing. They have to, you know, apply for it. But, given all the attention, there have been 76 million downloads of this, of Serial, and Sarah Koenig, the investigative reporter, was named by Time as one of the 100 most influential people of 2014. There's so much attention on this that I would think there'd be a little bit of pressure on the trial court to have that hearing.
I think there will be a hearing, and this may be enough to get him a new trial. I mean, these kinds of issues, we had in our practice, we had a murder case some years ago where we got a conviction reversed because the trial lawyer failed to properly investigate an alibi. And these, alibi witnesses are critical to a defense, and when lawyers, you know, don't call alibi witnesses, it raises issues on appeal that, you know, like we're seeing in this Adnan Syed case. So I think there is going to be a hearing, and, hopefully, Beth, you will continue to watch it for us, and we'll have to see what happens.
Absolutely. I'm very interested in it myself.
Very good. Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. Beth, thanks so much, as always.
My pleasure.
Speak to you soon. Now, we need to thank our guest today, Dr. Charlotte Laws. Check out her new book, Rebel in High Heels. You can find her book at rebelinhighheels.com. I want to thank Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. Go subscribe to her website to get all the latest on the James Holmes Colorado Theater shooting trial, the Jodi Arias case, and information about Adnan Syed's efforts to get a new trial. Thank you, Mark Goldman, my producer, who always does such a great job for us. Please follow the show by liking our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw, no G in talkin', facebook.com/talkinlaw. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. You can send me an email, talkinlaw.com. If you want to suggest a guest, make a comment about the show, email me at talkinlaw@gmail.com. Our next show will be next Wednesday at 9:30 a.m. We will bring you another great guest. Watch our facebook.com/talkinlaw page for details. I want to wish everybody peace and justice. Thank you.